Today's show is sponsored by Audible. Go to audiblepodcast.com/Dan Carlin and get a free 30-day trial membership.
The space aliens left him here, and they don't want him back.
Dan Carlin, common sense.
So I don't know when you're going to get this, but the other day the Iowa caucuses happened, and once again proved that this is just a crazy way to pick, you know, a president of the United States. If you don't know what the Iowa caucuses are, maybe you live outside the country. Since about 1972, I think it was, they've been the first actual chance Americans have to vote, you know, for president at any capacity, at any level, you know, in the primaries, right? Both parties have a caucus in Iowa that becomes the first chance anybody's had to have anything more than speculation, really, about, you know, how the candidates in this race should do. I mean, there have usually been debates by this point, always been debates by this point. So you've had a chance to, if you're the media, dissect that somewhat. And that's kooky when you think about it. More on that in a minute. But you've also had an increasing amount of time before the first vote. You know, it's getting longer and longer and longer how long ahead of time these presidential campaigns get going. So it's like the media and everyone else hyping this amazing meal, and you getting hungrier and hungrier and hungrier, and finally by Iowa, you get your first chance at anything, and it's like one piece of shrimp ceviche, you know, for you to gnaw on for a week before the next primary and dissect every little way it was spiced in the plating and everything else, but you finally got something to eat, a little bit, right? Something real, some vote totals. Well, maybe. Now, the first thing you have to say about Iowa is that, theoretically, this is not something that should matter at all. You do not need Iowa in any way, shape, and form to win the presidential election, you know, on election night. But there are always candidates when Iowa happens that are on the bubble, that are just barely holding on for dear life. And in the convoluted way our system works, money is how you decide whether or not you're viable. And if those people who are hanging on for dear life don't do well in Iowa, oftentimes, you know, their money sources just dry up. People who are already maybe not so sure that they should support this long shot see them as an even bigger long shot, right? We finally had some confirmation from the voters. Those polls weren't wrong, like you insinuated, Rand Paul. You're hopeless in this particular election cycle. You've moved too far to the establishment side, and it turns out to be a bad gamble in an anti-establishment era. No more money for you. And that shuts you down. That's what's crazy here is that, you know, like the Supreme Court had said, money is the way people measure support now. And so that's what Iowa's real impact on anything is that some of these people have to drop out of the race because they already were hanging on for dear life and then they didn't do well there. Of course, as we said and broke down in detail in a recent show, the idea that Iowa should be the first place to whittle things down is crazy. And, you know, when I say this, I always hear from people in Iowa who say, Dan, you're really underselling, you know, the amount of work we put into this and how seriously we take this responsibility as the first state, blah, blah, blah. I don't doubt any of that. But you're not representative of the great mass of the country as a whole, right? You're not urban. They're, you know, it's pretty white in Iowa. I mean, it's just not a diverse cross-section. And especially when you're talking about primaries, in the Republican primary, for example, you are talking about people who are a lot more conservative, a lot more evangelical, and a lot more, you know, culturally conservative than most of the country, especially the large populous states you need to actually win the election. By the time those states get a chance to weigh in, places like Iowa have winnowed down the field, and they're winnowing it through a lens that is not representative. Candidates that might have done just great in New York State, for example, might never get there because they didn't perform better in Iowa. It's crazy. And from Iowa now, we get to go to New Hampshire. Again, we mentioned this in the previous show on this topic, but this is another not representative state, right? So the process gets a chance and the media begins to call people out, and this becomes one of these things where you turn around at some point and go, you know, whoever actually emerges from this process as victor, or the two people who get to be the runoff candidates, the official Democratic and Republican nominee, what the heck does what it took to get to there have to do with what you're going to have to do once you get the job? Seems to me it's almost completely different skill sets at times. What it takes to actually win office, and then what it takes to do the job you were running for once you get the job. I mean, in my mind, this is crazy. And I think some of the candidates, I think I read an article where Ben Carson had said what we're making candidates go through, of course, it sounded self-serving, him being a candidate, but he's insane. I mean, the stress it takes on them, I mean, they're campaigning for years. And if you're really good at that job, so good that you crush the competition, does that necessarily mean you are the best person to get the job in the White House or the job in the Senate or the job in the Congress or whatever it is? I can think of a lot of really talented, gifted, administrative type of people who would not have done well in that sort of popularity contest. And not just a popularity contest. It's not like in some electoral systems where they say, okay, campaign season is 3 months, and then you have sort of an electoral sprint. This is an electoral marathon. And those administrative genius types, they have a whole different skill set, you know, than one that would allow them to be successful in a popularity contest that goes on for years, right? At a horrid, torrid pace. And yet they're exactly the kind of people you would wish would get the job because they'd be very gifted and competent, you know, at the work, right? So we have a system here that doesn't necessarily reward the sort of qualities we're looking for. It's like the debates, right? I've stopped tweeting during the debates. We started by live tweeting the debates earlier in the year, and I just stopped. Because other than the train wreck aspect of it, and that's a Trump thing. I mean, I watch, like any of you do, I think, for the fact that you just don't know what he's going to say, which is what makes the debates with him interesting, because if you are the heavily scripted and rehearsed, you know, competition that he faces that have, you know, test debate and practice debate after practice debate to try to, you know, war game every possible scenario. How would you answer this? How would you answer that? How do you put somebody in there to represent Trump? It's a little like when you face that other football team and they've got that quarterback who's, you know, a once in a generation guy. You can't really replicate that on the scout team. You can't replicate Trump on the scout team either, but it makes it fun to watch because normally this is a heavily scripted, heavily rehearsed kind of deal, and in which case there's no reason to watch or really even tweet about it. What makes it stupid, though, is look at what, once again, we're judging the candidates on. And remember, there weren't televised debates before 1960. And immediately, you saw the vacuousness creep into the debate when the debate between Kennedy and Nixon happened in 1960, you know, and Nixon was sweating. Not like pouring sweat, but the cameras picked up on it, and Kennedy looked calm, cool, and collected, as he always did, and it impacted people's perception of things, right? Well, fast forward, you know, a generation or two, and here we are today, when what we're waiting for here, and especially what the media is waiting for, is the headline moment. Whatever that might be, the amazing put-down, the great sense of humor, the disastrous flub, the campaign-killing moment. And if you don't think they can happen, does anybody remember Rick Perry? You know, at the last presidential election? In the Republican debates? He's standing next to Ron Paul, Rand Paul's father, and he says he's got, you know, three pieces of government, three departments of government he wants taken out, right? He volunteers this information, by the way, and then can't remember the third. And sits there flailing and fumbling in an uncomfortable way because he brought it up. It wasn't like the media gave him a gotcha question. And then they said, can you tell us? And he said, no. My favorite moment of that, too, is he turns to Ron Paul at one point, like looking for help. And Ron Paul, you know, he says, there's three departments of government. And Ron Paul goes, no, it's five. Anyway, there's a moment right there when the election is lost for that guy. And now, while I think that was probably indicative a little bit about Rick Perry, and I think that's a little bit how he would have governed, so maybe this isn't really making my point so well for me, but I thought to myself, okay, we're in front of millions. If you're up there, you're in front of millions of people. Have you ever been in front of hundreds of people and given a speech? I know many of you have. Look how easily you could flub like that. And then if you've ever done that, and speaking as one who has, by the way, your mind is trying to do like nine things at the same time, especially remembering your line of thinking and the point you were trying to make, and your brain can just shut down on you. It's a human thing. It could happen to anybody. But in this system we've created to help weed out political candidates, that's a fatal mistake. And yet again, does that have anything to do with what it would take to actually, you know, do the job? If it hadn't been Rick Perry in this case, if it had been somebody, you know, who'd be remarkably gifted, but they froze in the headlights as any of us could, and you disqualify them for that? Does that sound right? Does that sound like you're going to end up at the end with the people who've, you know, shown to you throughout the campaign and made the case and answered the questions showing that I would be the best person for this job? Or does it show you the person who survived, was lucky, was well-funded, played it as carefully as they could, didn't make any fatal mistakes, and was able to run a popularity contest marathon successfully? Maybe it explains why we haven't had better leadership for a while now, right? We have a system that's basically, you know, testing our candidates on a different set of criteria than what they will eventually need once they get elected. So since Iowa happened, Rand Paul dropped out, Rick Santorum dropped out, there were some dropouts, people who were marginally holding on anyway. Trump apparently came in second, gave a nice concession speech, as I understand it, and then turned around later and, you know, said he's going to sue Cruz. It was dirty tricks. Ben Carson accused Cruz of a message, a tweeted message that said he was out of the campaign. So, you know, I mean, there were some accusations, shall we say, of underhandedness on the Republican side. But Cruz came in first, by the way, and the polls had Trump leading. Don't believe the polls, folks. I mean, even I'll quote the polls, but let's understand how often they're wrong, especially on these presidential things. And Marco Rubio came in third, representing sort of the establishment candidate. And you're already hearing calls from the establishment mouthpieces out there saying to the other potential establishment candidates that they need to get out soon so that everyone can unite behind Rubio to scotch Trump and Cruz. Although I think it's interesting that the Republican establishment seems more willing to have Trump than Cruz. Really shows you what they think of Ted Cruz, doesn't it? On the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton apparently squeaked out a win by like 0.3 percentage points or something over Bernie Sanders. If you believe the poll, she was leading him by 20 points not that long ago in Iowa. So you have to consider this a kind of disappointment, even though, you know, it's being portrayed as a big deal. And by the way, after I had said that Iowa and the results were not a big deal, some people on Twitter responded to me that, yes, it is a big deal, Dan, because Iowa proved that a guy like Sanders could raise money from, you know, a lot of small donors and actually compete with, you know, the top candidates in a place like Iowa. Okay, a couple of things on this. Because one of them is sort of a bit of a revelation. And I think we saw this a little bit with Obama in 2008. Maybe that was the beginning of showing what was possible when he received quite a bit of money from small donors, too. Think about what this might mean, and I'm thinking out loud here, if we're going to suggest, and I think there's some truth to it, I'm not saying one way or the other, but think about what we're saying if we're saying that Bernie Sanders has proven that small donors across the country can give him enough money to be a viable force in a political system that only judges you on money. I mean, when candidates started dropping out after Iowa, why was that? Oh, the money was drying up. Gotta love a political system where that determines whether or not you get to continue forward to other states or not, especially when the state that knocked you out was not exactly representative of what you would encounter later on. Nonetheless, if it's true that Bernie Sanders proves that these small-time donors can do this, then must we perhaps consider or reconsider the way the court decisions on campaign finance reform, you know, have come out? Because isn't that kind of what the majority that's been so vilified, partly by, you know, the kind of people who would support Sanders, doesn't that sort of make their case for them? That enough people banding together with small donations can make up for, you know, a fewer number of mega donors? I think we should think about this a little bit. Maybe it does mean that. Maybe in the world, you know, we did a show called Kickstarting the Revolution once. I mean, maybe in a world where a podcast can survive on donations from listeners even when he barely gets a show out once a month sometimes. I mean, maybe that's a world where the power of those who could give a ton of money to campaigns is balanced out by a lot of smaller donors. I mean, let's give maybe a point to the Supreme Court there. Maybe what Bernie Sanders' money-raising feat has proven is that Scalia and company were right suggesting that the system could function like this and it wouldn't skew against, you know, the mass is too much. Interesting to think about, isn't it? Now, I should point out that there are charges of shenanigans, for lack of a better word, going on in the Iowa caucus on the Democratic side. And could anything better put on display what we talked about previously in a recent show where we talked about the various things that the parties have, you know, to sort of skew things a little bit this way and a little bit that way in terms of vote totals or outcomes that they want, because they are mistakenly assumed to be part of the constitutional system here that are governed by, you know, real laws and rules, when in fact they're private companies, nonprofit companies, but private companies that can kind of do what they want. I mean, you know, nobody wants to look underhanded and nobody wants to look like they're not on the up and up. But with whatever wiggle room we have, we can see, and it's proverbial. It goes back 100 years. I mean, there have been whole elections where people wondered whether, you know, Kennedy really beat Nixon in 60, for example, or was there a little mob activity helping out in certain places? I mean, you know, the accusations. I mean, what did Edgar Allan Poe die of, right? He was supposedly given drinks on election day to vote over and over and over again. A drink each vote. Overdosed. Now, I'm not saying anything as egregious as that went on in Iowa, but one of the major papers in Iowa has said the whole thing kind of smells, and there were coin tosses, apparently, in some precincts to determine whether Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton won that precinct. And then the vote totals, at this point when I'm recording this show right now, won't be released because the person who is the one who makes that decision has given like $8,000 to Hillary Clinton, has been appointed to her positions before by Hillary Clinton. I mean, this is how it works, folks. Don't be surprised. But when you sit there and go, well, this is a travesty. How can they not release the vote totals? It's a democracy. I mean, we have to know how people voted. We have to know, you know, who got what. No, this is something that can be decided by the head of Iowa's Democratic Party, right? They should release them. They might be shamed into it still, because sometimes the political pressure and the public pressure can become, you know, so overwhelming. But in terms of have to, must, law, things like that, no. You just have to accept what they said. Hillary Clinton won. Okay, there you go. I told you, if it's within a, you know, they're not, the party's not going to put their foot on the scale and help one candidate totally overcome a huge lead by the other. But when it's close, there's a little nudge and a little, you know, shove you can do here and there in the system, especially down at precinct levels, that can make a difference, you know, over the long haul. Anyone who remembers the whole shenanigans, is a good way to put it, or fiasco might be a better term, of the 2000 elections and how things came down to hanging chads in this county in Florida. It's insane, right? But when elections are close, that's where they're won or lost. And not always, folks, on the straight vote totals and this and that. There's room for maneuver, and everybody's elbowing everybody at the precinct level. So don't be surprised. Again, though, I think it exposes, you know, this element in the system that is somewhat veiled, the idea that the parties are a constitutional institution that were put in there by the founding fathers as part of the design. They're not. They came on afterwards, and they have, you know, no real obligation to the system at all other than to get their candidates elected. I'm not saying that's wrong, but I'm saying it is commonly misunderstood. Now, Ben is looking at me, if there is a Ben, like there is no point to this show. And I'm pointing out to him, Ben, the reason I'm having this conversation is because people on Twitter and in other places were asking for some Martian perspective on what's just happened because they don't get that. My analysis may suck, but it is mine and you cannot get it elsewhere. So I suppose there's some value in that to some people. And that's what we're doing here, breaking down where things are a little bit and what it means. And I have to tell you, and this is what weird people do, I suppose, but I'm already focusing on the 2020 election. I'm looking at the current trends and trying to project things outward a little bit. You know, this is hazy stuff, right? This is crazy stuff to try to actually bet on if you're a stock market person or anything like that. A little like deciding I'm going to bet on the World Series winner 4 years from now. We all know things can happen, right? I mean, historical wild cards get played. 9/11's happened. I mean, you know, all bets are off then. But if you project the current trends and what we're seeing now and what we're likely to see in terms of the outcomes of the 2016 election, it's interesting to speculate what the Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump candidacies and the public's reaction to them bode for the next presidential election. Because I will suggest that no matter what the outcome, both of them have sort of opened the door for other people who might be thinking about this, good and bad people, by the way. There is no, you know, automatic moral compass on these people. Anyone can exploit an opportunity. And I think Trump and Sanders are showing that there is one. It's an angry electorate. It's an electorate that is voting against the establishment and sometimes reflexively, I mean, I personally think, you know, I'm one of the people, one of the millions of people who said that Donald Trump will put his foot in his mouth at some point, say something inexcusable and ruin his campaign. And there's still time for that, ladies and gentlemen. But it hasn't happened yet. And an interesting dynamic has been proven by Mr. Trump. He's got a little bit of like what Ronald Reagan had. Ronald Reagan, when it came to things like scandals, was called the Teflon president because nothing stuck to him. Well, Donald Trump said the other day something to the effect of, I could shoot somebody and my poll numbers wouldn't go down. I'm not so sure he's far wrong, because he says things that should get him in trouble, but they don't. In fact, sometimes the poll numbers go up after he says them. And there's two ways to look at that. One way is that the establishment, you know, which includes the major media outlets and whatnot, have a different sort of sense of what is over the line. And they'll see Trump say something and they'll show it to Americans and say, can you believe he said this? He can't get away with saying this. And some of the electorate will go, we don't think what he said is as bad as you think. So you're wrong there, and it doesn't bother us like it bothers you. That's one thing. But the more reflexive side, this is what Trump is alluding to, I think, when he talks about, you know, shooting somebody in the, and not getting hurt in the polls, is a little like, you know, just giving your middle finger to the establishment. I think there's a lot of voters, Trump and Sanders voters, whose attitude is that the establishment, including the major media outlets, want their candidates to fail. So when they tell them something about their candidate that's negative, they say, I don't care what you say. I'm not listening. Donald Trump said this. I don't care. I don't believe it because it's from you. Screw you. You're not going to get me to stop voting for my candidate. A little bit reflexive anger. What happens in 4 years to that level of anger if the establishment candidates win again this year? And if you're a betting person in Vegas, you'd have to bet on that, wouldn't you? Because they're the House. You don't bet against the House if you're smart. You can win sometimes, but the odds are against you. In 2020, we may get some very interesting candidates who are looking at the situation now and saying, I could do better than that. I mean, if you just weren't as, you know, I mean, you think about a Trump kind of character and you think, what would that be like for the Republican field right now if it had all the things that people like about Trump and none of the drawbacks? I mean, a really strong outsider candidate who was pushing similar themes, but in more palatable ways. And let's be honest, not so clownish. I mean, there's a clownish side to the guy that surely can't help him unless it's for debate ratings and people like me watching the debates. And I look at Bernie Sanders and listen, God love you people who are really, really liking Bernie Sanders' positions and whatnot. I think that's about half of you, maybe 60%. But let's acknowledge that a lot of the support Bernie's seeing right now is more of a commentary on what people think of the Democratic establishment candidate, Hillary Clinton. Now, what's sad about the whole thing is it would be great to see a woman president. What's upsetting about it is that if you want that right now, she's got to be your choice, pretty much. And she's, I mean, you talk about, she's got a Nixon level of unlikability. Nixon rubbed people the wrong way and had this great resume and still had to overcome that dislikability factor. She's got the same thing going for her. She's got a great resume if you look at it. But God, she's got that same sort of aura that both Clintons have. There's just a sticky, sleazy something that Bill balances out with a lot of charisma, and she lacks the charisma, so you're just left with the sticky stuff. I mean, the one thing Bernie Sanders has to do after he does the improbable and takes the Democratic nomination is then try to, you know, get the middle of the country to vote for a guy who identifies as a Democratic socialist. I can't help but think, had there been a charismatic, because neither Clinton nor Sanders is particularly charismatic, a charismatic female, more liberal than Hillary Clinton, running as a Democrat, that she's getting crushed right now. I mean, I hate to say it this way, folks, but a Democratic socialist, 70-plus-year-old guy without a ton of charisma is hanging tough with Hillary Clinton. That's partially a, you know, big hand and round of applause for the job Bernie Sanders is doing, but it's also partially a knock at the job Hillary Clinton is as a candidate overall, right? And we saw this in 2008. I think a smart, charismatic, liberal female Democrat right now would be killing her. And it's a pity that there isn't one. Nonetheless, the reason that she and the Republican establishment candidates are having a problem is it is an anti-establishment year, isn't it? And it's clearly an anti-establishment year, and everyone sees it. The question is this temporary or is this permanent? And that's what I mean by thinking about the 2020 elections, because if it's not temporary, and I don't think it is, I think this has been building for a long time, then it's going to continue to increase in intensity. Let me read you a couple of these articles out here that I think help bolster my case in terms of what we're seeing here. And if current trends continue, right, no historical wild cards played or whatnot, you know, where does this road lead in 4 years? The first piece I'd like to quote from is from a January 29th, 2016 McClatchy piece by Leslie Clark, Anita Coomer, and Maria Riccio. It's entitled America 2016, We're Mad as Hell and Not Going to Take It Anymore. And it starts off, you know, with giving a personal profile of a guy who voted for Barack Obama twice and now is voting for Trump. And then a little farther down in the piece, it says, quote, if Obama's 2008 campaign in Iowa and beyond defined the election as one of hope and change, this year may well be described as the politics of rage. In interviews with dozens of voters in both parties, the story says, talking about Iowa, by the way, the driving motivation across the state is anger and uprising. They're fed up with lawmakers in Washington who seem to work 2 or 3 days a week and get little done aside from raising money to stay in office. They're mad about stagnant wages, companies sending jobs overseas, and terrorists sneaking in across the border. The rage is driving the campaigns of the, quote, end quote, outsiders. For Republicans, that's the bombastic Trump and his chief rival Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, with verbal assaults against his own Republican colleagues, end quote. Then it talks about the other side of the aisle, quote, on the Democratic side, the discontent fuels the insurgent campaign of Senator Bernie Sanders, an independent from Vermont, who vows a political revolution to fix what he sees as a system skewed to favor the rich. I plead guilty. This is Sanders speaking. I am angry. Sanders continued. I am angry, and millions of Americans are angry. We are angry that our people are working longer hours for lower wages. We're angry that our criminal justice system is broken. And we're angry that we have a corrupt campaign finance system that allows billionaires to buy elections. End quote. Now, here's the thing. If these people are tapping into that kind of anger, and those problems that people are angry about don't get any better between now and 2020, how mad are they going to be then? Who will they be willing to vote for then, especially if, you know, the Trumps and the Sanders get shot down this year, one way or the other? Now, there's another idea pushed in this McClatchy article that I think is interesting and worth talking about, because it involves something we've discussed on the program here before. Individually, we are all capable of learning, and learning from experience, right? But sometimes it's a logical question to ask whether or not large groups of people are capable of learning. I mean, take voters, for example. There are always, you know, young voters who come of age and are now, you know, part of the electorate who come in with very little political life memory experience, right? And there are older voters who've been watching elections forever who die off and leave the electorate. So there's always turnover, right? So it's hard to have any sort of electoral, shall we say, institutional memory. Now, on this program, we've described this with an analogy. We use the Charlie Brown Peanuts analogy of Charlie Brown being convinced over and over and over again by Lucy to take a chance on kicking the football. And every time she has a different excuse why she won't pull the football away this time, and every time she does, right? That's the perfect analogy for the fact that the voters never seem to learn and the promises always seem to be able to be tweaked enough to get you to try to kick the football again. Well, this article actually addresses the idea that maybe the electorate is learning. You know, they're learning that she's going to pull the football away. They're getting hip to the game because in such recent history, both sides have had a chance to be victorious in the political realm, and both sides have had a chance to be let down. The article says, quote, this deep anger is fed by power lurching back and forth between Republicans and Democrats over the past decade, raising hopes among Americans who favor one side, then dashing them when little changes thanks to mounting dysfunction in Washington, said Lee Meringhoff, the director of the Marist Institute for Public Opinion in New York. This is quoting this Lee Meringhoff guy now. Quote, it's just been too many times, and they just feel like nothing has worked. End quote. The story continues. Quote, that anger has prompted a look outside of politics, way outside.
Previously, Meringhoff said, governors were considered outsider candidates for the presidential nomination. Now outsiders have scarcely any political experience. Quote, our politics have changed, Meringhoff said, adding that there's a growing mistrust of institutions, including government, the healthcare system, and the media and pollsters, end quote.
You know, if that's true, and the electorate is becoming hip, you know, to how it's all going, that might explain why the establishment candidates can't get any traction, because everything they try is mistrusted. People don't believe them. And if they don't believe them, if there's a credibility gap, you know, how do they ever get that trust back? In other words, let's say you're the Marco Rubio campaign. Right now, he seems the establishment darling on the GOP side. And the pollsters come back and say, listen, it's obvious. Look at the support Trump's getting. Look at the support, you know, Bernie Sanders is getting. It's obvious that authenticity is what the electorate wants this year. So you've got to be more authentic. It reminds me of something I read when Hillary Clinton was being pilloried by the press for being too robotic and scripted. It said something like, you know, the focus group or whatever. We're going to work on, organizing ourselves to be more spontaneous or whatever it was. But if you're, you know, Rubio in the room with the consultants, what do you do about that, right? How do you all of a sudden decide, you know what, you're right, we have to be more authentic, and I'll turn around and start saying things that sound, you know, more like real thought-out ideas than bullet slogans. You've already screwed the pooch on this. I mean, nobody believes you anyway. You know, you're like the boy who cried wolf, and you can't all of a sudden decide, you know what, we're not going to tell any lies anymore because people aren't going to believe you anyway. There's no way the establishment candidates can all of a sudden brand themselves as the outsiders. You know, there's too much of a track record. And look at how it hurt Rand Paul, by the way, who's out of the race now, who dropped out after Iowa. I mean, he really picked the wrong time to go conventional wisdom. His father, with his father's beliefs, would have done better than Rand Paul did, because Rand Paul tried to moderate, you know, what was considered to be the more, you know, kooky edge of Ron Paul's beliefs, but moderated them by going more toward the establishment Republicans on them, just in time to run for president in a year when anti-establishment is in. So bad move there, Rand, I'm afraid. Now, one thing that's worth mentioning, and I'm sure there's a lot of people outside the United States that have been thinking this throughout the whole show today, there's something about this that is not uniquely American. If I could use air quotes with my fingers, the establishment, and let's understand, when you use a word like that, there's always an establishment. Wherever you are in history, there's an establishment. When there were caveman, you know, villages, there were always the crowd that was still those four guys. That's the establishment. I mean, it basically refers to something that happens naturally. But this anti-establishment mood seems to be in a lot of countries in the world right now. I mean, you can see evidence of this all throughout Europe with outsider and really, you know, parties and I'll quote something from columnist Eugene Robinson in a second, but really parties that are talking about big time change, not nibbling at the edges. You're seeing this all over the place right now. It's a mood that is sweeping the democracy, shall we say, of the planet right now. I mean, the whole Jeremy Corbyn thing in Britain has been marvelous to watch. And I'm learning a lot, by the way. You know, the internal politics of any country is very hard for outsiders to really divine and know all the little shades of gray. But as I watch it, I'm learning a lot about British politics. And it's fascinating to see how their establishment is reacting with just its open horror, really. And that same sort of sense, you get a sense of, gosh, you know, are they tempted to maybe just say, no, this is too far. You can't do this. I love you, voters, and you're allowed to vote. Jeremy Corbyn's too far. I mean, I read one article that made it sound like at some point the government just might have to put a stop to this nonsense. We can't have a Jeremy Corbyn. Anyway, it's fun to watch. We have similar dynamics, British folks over here sometimes. And Jeremy Corbyn may be a leftist version of this, and we saw that in Greece not that long ago, right? Look how horrifying that was to sort of the international free trade, IMF. Austerity thing. I mean, that was frightful, scared the heck out of a lot of people. But after terrorist attacks in Europe, I mean, the rise of the right in France, you see stirrings of German nationalism in Germany, which, you know, for a guy my age, it's almost impossible to believe. I mean, you look and you see the rise of those flags again, and you thought, my goodness, what kind of an international mood has to be taking place to prompt that sort of reaction? Well, it's the same reaction in one form or another you're seeing in a bunch of countries right now. Now, it's not always totally extremist in that direction, but it's this mood that, listen, the establishment's ideas for change are a combination of not enough and self-serving, you know, towards them. And so people want something different right now. And I should point out, listen, when I say to people, you know, that the Democrats and Republicans, for example, don't have a whole lot of difference between them, they'll get angry with me and say, yes, they do. And in other countries, that's similar, by the way. But in the establishment sort of range of motion, shall we say, it's a little like the steering wheel on a ship. And you can go, for example, to a Marco Rubio and turn that wheel to the right 1 degree, or a Hillary Clinton and turn that wheel to the left 1 degree from center. And in 200, 300 miles, that will change that ship's course, you know, quite a lot. You'll have different destinations. You really will. But it depends on what you're trying to avoid sometimes. And we've used the metaphor of an iceberg to represent all kinds of, you know, stresses and strains and impediments and dangers in our future. If that iceberg is 15 miles away from you, all of a sudden that 1% turn on the wheel, which might feel good to parents like me, who are scared to try anything that isn't conservative, because after all, we have kids to think about, right? I mean, we're about stability, we conservative dad types. 1% sounds like more than enough to me. At the same time, if it's not going to make you get out of the way of the iceberg, 1% doesn't do the trick. That's why a Bernie Sanders, for example, he's a 4% turn from center, maybe. You know, I guess what I'm saying is that all around the world, they're looking at this and going, 1% is not enough of a turn, and 1% is what the establishment offers us in terms of our change option range of motion, if you will. This piece I have here is from Eugene Robinson. He writes for the Washington Post, but this appeared in my local paper on January 30th, 2016, and he makes a point about the change in the electorate and how Trump and Sanders are symptoms of this, and that it's not going away. As I said, I'm thinking about the 2020 election and imagining the level of anti-establishment feeling we have now, and that Britain has now, and that France has now, and that Germany has now, and that Europe has now, and projecting it outward, especially after establishment victories in some of these places. From the beginning of the Robinson piece, quote, "Whoever wins Monday in Iowa, and whoever eventually wins the presidential nominations, one thing is already clear. Traditional politics and politicians have failed. That glaring fact is still difficult for the establishment of both parties to grasp." End quote. From later in the piece, he contrasts and compares Sanders and Trump. Quote, "As individuals, Sanders and Trump are hardly cut from the same cloth. One rails against billionaires, and one is a billionaire. Their supporters would probably not mix well at a cocktail party, but there's a reason these are the only two candidates who regularly fill basketball arenas with passionate, standing-room-only crowds. Both call for change that is fundamental, not cosmetic or incremental." End quote. He then goes on to point out that even though, you know, they're supposed to be from, you know, opposite ends of the political spectrum, there's some stuff that they agree upon, which is exactly the sort of stuff the establishment doesn't. And we've talked about this before. This is kind of how the establishment keeps the public from weighing in on certain things. You know, if you live in a quote, end quote, two-party system as we do, you know, how do you register you'd like to change course on any issue if both parties agree on that issue? For example, in foreign policy, we call it the bipartisan consensus on foreign policy. What does that mean? If you don't share that bipartisan consensus, tough luck. It's a two-party system, basically. Go vote Libertarian. Go vote Green, right? So Robinson said that both Trump and Sanders denounced the free trade agreements like NAFTA, GATT, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and all that, that the establishment strongly favors, for example. And Hillary Clinton came out against them because so much of the crowd, you know, that they're polling doesn't like them. But she not only supports it, she said great things about it in the past. Another reason Clinton's a tough candidate to like, because she morphs into different things, which is pretty typical for politicians. Then Robinson says that both Sanders and Trump favor some sort of health care and talks about that. And then he says this, which, of course, you know, for a person who thinks we do this too much myself, this is near and dear to my heart, but it also shows why you have to vote outside the establishment if you feel this way about foreign policy. Robinson writes, quote, "Trump and Sanders are both skeptical of the establishment consensus about America's role as the world's policeman. Sanders would use military force only as a last resort.
Trump would let Vladimir Putin take charge of cleaning up the Syria mess if he wants to. And then he writes this, quote, "Perhaps most significant of all, Trump and Sanders both portray the traditional politicians as bought and paid for by powerful moneyed interest. Sanders rails against big banks, powerful corporations, and wealthy plutocrats who bend the system to their will. Trump speaks from personal experience, blithely telling audiences how he regularly wrote big checks to politicians in both parties to buy access and influence. The system is rigged, these insurgents say. Your elected leaders are working for themselves and their puppet masters. They couldn't care less about you." End quote. That's the mood. Is that going to get better or worse by 2020? And if it gets worse, what will people vote for and who will be running? Here's the way Robinson ends his piece. He gives some polling numbers that essentially show that like 37% of Democrats are saying that they favor Sanders, and 36% of Republicans favor Trump. Take these polls with a grain of salt, by the way. And then ends the article by saying, quote, "These numbers should be nothing short of alarming to the party establishments. They show that there are huge numbers of Americans out there whose voices are not being heard. Voters who are tired of half measures and unkept promises. Whatever happens between now and November, this alienation will not magically disappear. Political parties that lose touch with their constituents end up going the way of the Whigs." End quote. Full disclosure, I have been called by some, in sneering tones, the second coming of a Whig. So, you know, I might be biased. But that pretty much lays it out there, right? What happens when the parties can't change enough to match the mood because the mood is too far outside what the establishment can morph into comfortably? As Robinson says, this is a sign that millions of Americans' voices are not being heard. The problem is that the people who are in power, by and large, don't like what these other people have to say, and they don't want to do what they want. Now, remember, part of what is supposed to make these parties flexible enough to deal with changing times and circumstances is their ability to evolve and change and grow. And you've seen this in history, you know, if you know your party history, right? In 68, there were riots outside of Chicago. The riots weren't between Democrats and Republicans. They were between Democrats and Democrats who were farther on the left than the other Democrats. In 72, those insurgents took over the party and the Democrats moved to the left. In 64, the Republicans lost an election because they, you know, put somebody up against Lyndon Johnson that was too conservative for the times, a guy named Barry Goldwater, a devotee of whom was another guy named Ronald Reagan, who moved the party to the right with the ideas of Goldwater in 1980. The Democrats moved back to the right with Bill Clinton in 1992. So the parties can move. The problem is when the public wants them to move farther than the establishment wants to go. There was a reason that you had to have riots outside the Democratic convention in 1968. That's because the people who wanted the party to move farther to the left couldn't get it to do that. Now, here's the thing. Whereas the establishment may not be flexible enough to adopt the positions of the public, which are getting increasingly more anti-establishment, they can modify the rhetoric to do that. And I think that's kind of what's gotten us here in the past. Politicians have been able to sense the mood, and the mood has been getting angrier for a while, and react to it, right? And get votes based on it, right? The problem is, and that this is what this McClatchy article we quoted earlier alluded to, is that the people are wising up to the fact that it's only been rhetoric that moved. The actual policies didn't. And that's why we're at a rubber meets the road period here now, because, you know, people are voting for candidates outside the establishment and won't vote for the establishment candidates because they don't believe the establishment candidates will do what they say if they start saying that they'll do what so many of these, you know, Americans whose voices are not being heard want them to do. We've hit a period of stress here where it's questionable whether the systems that we have in place can change fast enough to deal with what the people want in governments that are supposed to be run by the will of the people. None of this matters if you're in, you know, some government where the will of the people isn't that important, but theoretically, it's everything here.
This is why you might have some very interesting things happening at these conventions. And we talked about things like superdelegates and other potential, they're almost doomsday devices in a way at this point. I mean, if they deny the election to some of these anti-establishment candidates because they've got these little mechanisms that most people don't even know about, I have no idea what people will do. I mean, you can look right now at how upset people are about this Hillary Clinton Democratic Party in Iowa not releasing the actual vote totals of the caucus. I mean, that would be nothing compared to, oh, yes, we know that Bernie Sanders got the majority of the votes, but, oh, what do you know? Superdelegates made up the difference. Hillary wins. Ugh, that's an interesting moment in U.S. history right there, isn't it? Especially given the mood. And that's why I keep thinking about 2020. And I keep wondering, you know, what the current level of anger is going to be with four more years to intensify and throw gasoline on the flames, right? And here's where things start to flip and get funny on you, right? Because here I am basically, obviously, supporting the anti-establishment side of this, and I only have 20 years of history or more behind me to do that, right? At the same time, let's ask a funny question. And when you talk about stressful periods in history that open up the doors to strange things happening, it's worth asking these kind of things. If this were a country where a really nasty person were in the election, right? Somebody, hate to go to Godwin's law, but it's fun to go to the Hitler thing, right? And say, okay, so you've got a Hitler or a new Hitler or a Hitler light running for office. And listen, there are some countries in Europe right now where this is not inconceivable in 4, 5, or 6 years if current trends continue. And the establishment, by hook or by crook, manages to not give the voting public what they want. If what the voting public wants is Hitler light, is that a positive thing or a negative thing? In other words, you know, is this very establishment that most of us are ready to tweak in the face, and I think rightly so, is it in a way a protective measure that keeps us, the people, from going too far off the rails when we let our anger get the best of us? Is it an element of ballast, maybe you could say political ballast, in a system that keeps it from tipping too far one way or the other? As we said, it's almost that ship analogy, right? You can turn that wheel to the left 1% with Hillary Clinton or the right 1% with Marco Rubio, but nobody's doing a full 180. Even if that's what the people want? Well, I think a lot of this has been, you know, building for a long time. It's been very apparent. Just look at the differences, for example, in the Republican Party between the, you know, age-old so-called Rockefeller Republicans of Wall Street and the titans of business and the chambers of commerce and all that, and the other wing of that party that's been hugely important to winning elections, the evangelical Christians, the Bible Belt folks, the libertarian conservatives, the rural folk. I mean, you know, there's a whole family values side of things and anti-abortion side of things and, you know, whole cultural qualities that the GOP has fanned and used to win elections for a long time now. But issues that, let's be honest, most of the Wall Street tycoons couldn't care less about or sometimes actually feel 180 degrees differently about than the, you know, salt of the earth Republicans, for example, in rural states. Here's the problem. What happens when those people have been pandered to forever in order to get their votes and been rooked time after time again in terms of getting what they want, right? Once the election's over, we break campaign promises and everything's back to normal. Eventually, as these articles suggest, they may be wising up. And this institutional memory of an entire electorate, if both sides are cheated in a short-term enough period, maybe they can learn. And on the Democratic side, listen, the Democrats have won a lot of elections since 1992 when the party became more business-friendly, started accepting contributions from basically the same people, and trying to out-Republican the Republicans on things like free trade and neoconservatism and all that kind of stuff. This is a little like the chickens coming home to roost as well. And as I said, I think it would be even more apparent if we didn't have a guy doing so well right now who's an admitted socialist. I can think of very few tags, by the way, that would get you more trouble in the system. Admitted Nazi would be worse. But in a system that's where people have been conditioned forever that socialism and Marxism and Stalin are basically all the same thing, it's shocking he's doing this well. And as I said, it's more of a symptom in many ways of the establishment Clinton candidate here just managing to get people to look for other options. And I still say, if we had a charismatic, smart, liberal female to oppose her, she'd be getting steamrolled right now. But what if she wins? Or what if Marco Rubio wins in this climate? And we get exactly what we would expect to get from either one of those people, right? More of the same. And then we get to 2020, and major people out there have seen the success, the near success that a Donald Trump and a Bernie Sanders can have. And they also see an electorate that is mad as hell and ready for a fight. This is an interesting game we're playing here in a stressful time that we're all entering into. And if Americans want to see what their future might look like under certain circumstances, they might cast a watchful eye to Europe over the next couple of years, because some of those countries are stressful now in their electoral systems. It's going to be an interesting next 4 years, and the 2020 election could be pivotal indeed in monumental ways. Of course, let's not ignore the other possibility that these anti-establishments, either in the United States or other countries around the world, could win and turn out to be as disastrous as the establishment always said they were. It's at times like these, once again, that you look at the way we pick presidents in this country and you say, you know, it could be an absolutely fatal downside over the long haul that we pick people based on stuff that has nothing to do, you know, with what it will take to do their job once they're elected. And this is a time period where we could really use some genius in government. And we have a system that seems to me built to prevent just that sort of outcome. Audible is the internet's leading provider of spoken audio entertainment. Sometimes that means audiobooks, but there's a whole lot more, as we've said before. Right now, there are over 180,000 individual offerings, and that's a number that's growing all the time. Programs that are provided by, you know, leading audiobook publishers, broadcasters, entertainers, magazine and newspaper publishers, business information providers, includes old-time radio shows, comedy bits, magazine articles, greatest speeches in history. There's something for everybody on Audible. And I have to admit, it sometimes gets me into trouble. I'm often, you know, forced to wonder whether Audible's entire reason for sponsoring this program is simply because they're sucking me into so many book purchases. It might be a monstrous scam here. I'm starting to feel like one of those local bands that shows up to play at the local tavern, and at the end of the night when they go to get paid, once the band's bar tab is deducted from, you know, their pay, they end up owing the tavern owner money. Thanks, Audible. Because every time I look for a book to recommend to you on Audible, you know, and I always search for ones I've read so that I can give you an honest sort of a recommendation, I find a bunch of books I haven't read yet that grab and hold me. I mean, if you've got almost 200,000 titles, that could happen to you. And then so along the way to recommending a book to you, Audible gets me for a couple of new ones themselves. I mean, I'll give you two right here that I couldn't resist. One I really should have. I shouldn't have probably gotten Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam by Nick Turse. And the reason why is I was reading the reviews, and they can be so white-hot, five-star, one-star, veterans mad at other vets. I mean, it's just one of those things where once I read the reviews, I'm like, well, I have to see what all the fuss is about. And I went and did some online research, and there's lots of fussing involved in this, and so it sucked me in like a, you know, military history fans magazine or something. I have to see what the fuss is about. So I'm picking that up. Got me there, Audible. There's another one on a subject I can't resist. This one's called Exercising Hitler, The Occupation and Denazification of Germany by Frederick Taylor. I just read a book about this same situation in Japan, where after the war they have to sort of deprogram or reprogram the population to make them able to govern themselves after a period where, you know, things have been rather traumatic, to say the least. I've read stuff on the Nazi Germany version of this before. I stumbled along this looking for a book to recommend to you, and I'm hooked. Books have a way of doing that, don't they? Which is why I want to warn you before I tell you that if you go to audiblepodcast.com/Dan Carlin right now, you can get a free 30-day trial. And that's great, but be careful. You could get sucked in like I'm sucked in, and then what do you do? And Audible has ways to keep you even hooked and make the experience even more addicting. How about their app that they provide now? It includes chapter navigation,
annotated bookmarks, a sleep mode. This is a really cool feature. And narration speed control, where you can control how quickly or how slowly it's narrated. I hear there's a bunch of you that do this with my show already. And I've heard from some of you that I sound better at 45 speed than the whatever the natural one is. There's a 30-second rewind, a button-free mode. There's even something you can get involved in called a great listener guarantee, where if you don't like the book you choose, you can return it for a new one. That's worth looking into. And if this all sounds good to you, well, why don't you go to audiblepodcast.com/Dan Carlin and get your free 30-day trial.
Want to help the podcasts? Just buy your Amazon.com products through the Amazon search window on dancarlin.com, and Dan and Ben will get a percentage of what you spend, and it won't cost you a penny more.
If you think the show you just heard is worth a dollar, Dan and Ben would love to have it. For less than the price of a cup of coffee, you can help keep the common sense coming. A buck a show. It's all we ask. Go to dancarlin.com for information on how to donate to the show.